The third case for oral argument this morning is the First National Bank Association versus Michael and Linda Scott. We would like to welcome the Freeman High School to the attendance of this argument. Before we also start this argument, I should note that Justice Sabers has disqualified himself from participating in this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Glenn Ng, a judge of the First Judicial Circuit from Yankton, to sit in his place. For the appellants is Mr. Gale Fisher, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and for the appellee would be Mr. James Moore, an attorney from Sioux Falls. Mr. Fisher, you may proceed, sir.
May it please the court. This is an appeal from a summary judgment entered by the trial court after the court reviewed two opposing amortization schedules and then decided that the bank's amortization schedule was more credible than the Scott's and entered summary judgment. The bank admits that this case involves a dispute over the amount of principal due on a promissory note. A dispute. And the question is that the court is facing is there a disputed fact issue in this case which precludes summary judgment? And we submit that there is. This started out in 1985 with a loan to the Scotts of $220,000 to set up a restaurant in Sioux Falls. And the business failed, and the Scotts kept making payments according to the note, which was changed three separate times by a document called an allonge. And the note was to be paid off over 10 years. So at the end of 10 years, in 1995, this company had been out of business some 7 or 8 years, but the Scotts knew that its bank in Yankton, First Dakota State Bank, First Dakota National Bank, was debiting their account every month and crediting the account of Western Bank. So the loan was originally taken out with Western Bank. Western Bank eventually was bought out by First National Bank, or First Bank of South Dakota, National Bank of South Dakota, then was bought out by U.S. Bank, so this is the third bank that's taken over this account. And so after 10 years, Scotts get a notice that there's $109,000 left owing on this note. And so Mr. Scott went to his CPA, Kyle Rep, in Yankton, and explain the situation with him. And that at that time, in 1995, the CPA kept all of the tax returns going back for 10 years. So Mr. Rep had files of the income taxes for the Scotts from 86, 87, all the way up to 1995. And he opened up these records and he looked at the amounts that the Scotts had paid. In other words, every year, Western Bank sent Scott a customer summary, which was a document that shows how much interest was paid and how much principal was paid on this note.
Mr. Fisher, were those documents that the bank sent, were those ever provided to the lower court? The documents that you just referred to from from the bank that they would have provided to your client to do his income tax?
What happened?
Were those ever found or supplied?
Some of them were, Your Honor, because what happens is the deposition of Kyle Rep was not taken until March 16, 2001. So by that time, Rep testified that I don't have the 86, 87, 88, 89, and 90 tax returns anymore. All I have is 91 through 2001 for 10 years going back. But at the time he prepared his amortization schedule, he did have those documents, and he testified at his deposition that he took what the Western Bank's record showed to be interest paid in 88, principal paid in 88, and added those together, and that totaled up the amount of the payments that the Scotts made in those years. So even though he didn't have those records at his deposition, 5 years of them had been disposed of because they only keep records going back 10 years for IRS audit purposes.
How about your clients? Didn't they keep their copies?
No. Well, what happened is Mike Scott had two garages or storage buildings full of boxes of records that involved a Wendy's from Norfolk, Nebraska, and some other businesses that he had. And there were hundreds and hundreds of boxes that he went through about 60 to 70% of them. But as he said in his affidavit, he assumed that when the bank came into court to show how they arrived at $109,000, they would produce all of these records. So,
well, wasn't it an evidentiary basis that the court relied upon in not admitting that amortization schedule because the documentation wasn't provided to the other side or wasn't available, so therefore there was no indication that it would be admissible, even if you were to proceed with the evidence?
Well, it was as admissible as the bank's amortization schedule because the bank didn't have any records either. And so it was our position that the bank has the burden of proving how they arrived at a balance of $109,000. This is not a case that the UCC 3-308, that back then it was 307, says that when you put the note into evidence, you've established a prima facie case to collect on the note. Okay? But this is not a $10,000 note where no payments had been made. And I've cited in my brief the applicable rule in this situation is found at 60M year payment in a case cited, Swift versus Kelly, which says as follows. When the debtor, Scotts, introduced some evidence of payment, the burden of going forward with the evidence, as distinct from the general burden of proof, shifts to the creditor, who is then under the duty of producing some evidence to show non-payment.
But wouldn't that be a requirement that be admissible evidence?
Well,
that amortization schedule of the Scotts has to be admissible. Is that not correct?
Well, it's our position first that the amortization schedule of the banks must also be admissible because the bank has the burden of showing how much the Scotts have not paid. And after that, after they prove that with admissible proof, then it is the Scotts' responsibility to come forward with some evidence as to what amounts they have paid. And our evidence is not just this amortization schedule. It's the testimony and the deposition of the CPA, Kyle Rep, who explained precisely how he got that number from the records that Western Bank had provided them. So...
If I understand correctly, though, you took the position at the summary judgment hearing that your client owed no money at all, that he had paid it all. Is that right?
Yes.
And I'm confused now, though, because I understand that after the judge granted summary judgment for the bank, your client came back into court and said, well, that's not right. We do owe some money. We just don't owe the money that the bank says we owe. Your client then says he owes $65,000.
Yes.
So isn't that an indication that your amortization schedule that you're talking about now is not useful? If you're conceding now that it, if it proves he owes nothing and you concede that that amortization schedule, you have to concede that that's wrong.
Well, it's our position that now creates a jury question. We've got all of these numbers. We've got different numbers. And if you want to, if you look at the bank's amortization schedule, you'll see at the very beginning, the very first year, we know that $2,270 was deducted out of Scott's account every month by the bank in Yankton. And this amortization schedule shows that all of that money went to pay interest and none of that money went to pay principal. Well, that would raise a flag in somebody's mind. Wait a minute, you make a payment, you allocate part to interest, part to principal. So what's wrong with this picture? That's the very first thing I noticed. And the second thing about this amortization schedule of the banks is on April 24, '89, they show a payment of $1,811.31, which they applied to principal and nothing to interest. Where did this number come from? Because in Mike Scott's affidavit, he attaches a document from the First Dakota National Bank for that month, April 27, '89, that shows Western Bank was paid $2,270. And the bank says, we only got $1,811 and we applied that to principal. So explain that to a jury. So we have, as I said, a dispute between two amortization schedules. If the court says, well, ours isn't any good because, as Justice Konenkamp pointed out, we didn't know that the trial court was going to stick us with a burden of proof until that time because of what we had read and researched from, as I've pointed out in my brief, you know, when the amount is disputed, the person who's seeking to collect it has to show how they got that number, $109,000. So now the judge says, well, we've got to prove by evidence some different amount. So now, after the judgment of some $200,000 with interest and everything, Mike goes back and goes through the rest of his two warehouses, and after searching for 2 months, he found some records and statements from Western Bank, and he took them to his accountant. And Mr. Rep, with this information, plugged in these numbers, and he comes up with a number of some $56,000 that's owing, which is a far cry from 109, but again, it shows that there are disputed numbers here. And to let this judgment of $200,000 stand on this record is just not justice. So,
Mr. Fisher, tell me how UCC, and in particular the burden shifting requirements in Rule 308, how does that interface with the burdens that we traditionally apply in summary judgment, in deciding summary judgment cases?
All right. The bank, had the bank put in the note, which I think they did, $220,000, and with nothing else, at that point, the burden would shift to Mike Scott to show that he's made some payments on it. And Mike Scott did that. He put in evidence, a deposition, an amortization schedule. He put in evidence. Now, we need a jury to weigh that evidence. We need to have a jury decide what happened in this case. Now, the bank says, we got payments, we're suing for $109,000. And we say, well, where's the evidence of that? And, well, we lost. And the SBA wouldn't even take that obligation as they signed the contract to do, because the SBA concluded.
Let me interrupt you.
All right.
I'm asking you a legal argument.
Yeah.
I want to know how Rule 308 of the UCC applies in a summary judgment case. Is 308 intended to apply to the burdens at trial before a judge or jury? And if so, is there a different standard that should apply, or a different burden, I should say, at the summary judgment stage of a case?
I think that probably in 90% of the cases, the creditor is suing on the note, the face amount of the note. And they put in the note into evidence, and then the burden shifts under 308. The burden now shifts to Scott. And Scott has to show payments. But the cases that I've cited in my brief, those cases say that once a summary judgment is made, a motion for summary judgment is made, then the adverse party may not rest upon the allegation or denials, but his response by affidavits or otherwise must set forth specific facts showing that there is a genuine issue for trial. If he does not so respond, which Scott did in this case, he responded. But this case says if he does not respond, then summary judgment, if appropriate, should be entered against him. But on the other hand, if he does respond, then the burden of going forward with the evidence shifts back to the plaintiff. And they have to show by some evidence what amount is owing. So that's what the bank relied upon. Now, UCC 4-406, which I didn't cite in my brief, but that's a banking statute that now requires banks to keep all of these records going back 7 years. And it would have been a lot easier in this case had the bank done that, but the bank lost all the records. But the records that we have were the records in the files of the CPA, Mr. Rep, which have been destroyed because they only keep records for 10 years. And this lawsuit wasn't started until 1998, I think.
Mr. Fisher, is there another rule of evidence that may apply to make this admissible when there are lost records, or that the records have been destroyed? Is there another evidentiary rule that perhaps could have convinced the court that there was, that these the amortization schedule would be credible, and
well,
or at least presented to the jury?
Up until the day of the hearing on the motion for summary judgment, I fully expected the bank to have some evidence of how they arrived at $109,000, but they had none of the evidence to support the summary. And in order for the summary, which is what this amortization schedule is, in order for that summary to be admissible, they have to have all of these underlying records to show how they got that. That was a case I had up here many, many years ago, a Dreyer versus Perfection. Okay? But to just come in and say, here's my summary and here's what you owe, That's not enough, but the trial court accepted it, even with all of these errors on it that I pointed out. The trial court focused on the amortization schedule of the Scotts and found some things that they couldn't, that the bank argued show inconsistencies. So now the court is in this position of having to weigh these evidence and decides which is the most credible. And she gave more weight to the bank's record, even with the errors on the face, than she did to the Scotts or Kyle Repp's sworn testimony. And I don't believe that that's the function of the trial court on a motion for summary judgment. Now, lost records, I don't know if there is an exception. We just did the best we could to get the evidence to show that the amount the bank was claiming was not correct.
Your time has expired, Mr. Fisher.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Moore, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. I think that the important thing to start out with is that the evidence on which Mr. Fisher wants to rely to create a question of fact has to be informed by the burden of proof. And I think ultimately it's contrary to the burden of proof because the evidence that he wants to point as establishing a question of fact is evidence that the bank submitted that the bank has no legal obligation to submit. To create a question of fact in this case that would prevent summary judgment, what Mr. Fisher needs is evidence of payment because his client has the statutory burden of proving payment as an affirmative defense. Given that it's clear that Mr. Scott's testimony that I made payments every month, but he has no documents to support that, is not itself sufficient. The only other evidence on which Mr. Scott could rely would be the amortization schedule of his accountant, Kyle Repp. And there are a lot of evidentiary problems with that statement.
But he also can't get it from the bank, which should have probably been the one that you'd rely on to give you that information of what you paid which year.
And one thing that's important at the outset, Your Honor, is that it's not as if the bank has no records in this case. What happened is when the loan was converted from Western Bank to First Bank, which purchased the assets of Western Bank, the amortization schedule was prepared starting at that point, and there's a loan balance that shows there is not a history before that time because someone in connection with either Western Bank or First Bank at the time of the sale decided that records older than 10 years would not be retained automatically, and so those records were destroyed. There are records from 1988 forward through maturity on August 21st of 1995, and those records, in fact, about which there is no dispute, establish all of the problems that existed with Mr. Repp's amortization schedule. Justice Meyer-Henry, I think you're correct that ultimately at trial, Mr. Repp's amortization schedule would not be admissible. I'd start with the Hodevec versus Howe case, which says basically you can submit a summary of records for the sake of convenience at trial as long as you have all of the underlying records to support that summary. And in this case, we don't have those, and it's very clear. Your Honor, there are a couple of procedural rules that should apply in this case. One of which is a local rule in the Second Circuit concerning summary judgment motions, and that is that you submit a statement of undisputed material facts in support of a motion for summary judgment, and if the other side does not respond to the statement of undisputed material facts by showing specific questions of fact with respect to each statement, the statements are deemed admitted. In this case, U.S. Bank submitted a statement of fact in support of its motion, paragraph 38. Repp prepared the amortization schedule solely upon the basis of the Scott's own representations of what had happened 10 years earlier and upon assorted tax returns of the Scott's, which did not indicate the amount of principal and interest paid on the notes. The Scott's did not provide Repp with bank statements, canceled checks, or any other documentation showing what, if any, payments had been made on the note.
But isn't it just as arguable that the bank's amortization schedule is subject to the same information.
Except that the bank has no burden of proof with respect to the amortization schedule, Your Honor. And that's the Premier Bank case from Louisiana. It's the logical corollary of the legislative determination that the South Dakota legislature made in adopting this provision of the Uniform Commercial Code. Once the note has been offered on its face and there's no question about the validity of the signatures on its note, payment is an affirmative defense. And for payment to be an affirmative defense, the bank doesn't have any burden of proving the amount of the debt once it shows the debt.
Isn't that going to come to some surprise, though, to a lot of mortgage payers in South Dakota who have paid over 30 years, and then the bank sues them for the entire note because they claim that they don't have to have any records showing there was payment?
Well, one, as a practical matter, Your Honor, I don't think that's likely to happen because, as in this case, the bank didn't do that. The bank gave the Scotts the benefit of what it established was the amount that was due at the date of maturity based on the records that it did have. Two, I think that reflects a legislative judgment and not a judicial judgment. By adopting the Uniform Commercial Code, the legislature has said it is, in fact, the burden of the obligor to prove that payment was made. And I think that you could establish all kinds of reasons why that would be a valid legislative judgment to make in the context of commercial transactions. After all, it is certainly some benefit to the Scotts that U.S. Bank or Western Bank at the time was willing to loan $220,000 for them to start up a business that, in fact, ultimately failed. And placing the burden on the Scotts to establish payment makes sense in that context.
Remember again, this is summary judgment. In Rule 308, I asked this of Mr. Fisher, I'd like to ask you as well. It seems to me that the burden shifting in Rule 308 is not unlike any other affirmative defense. And so when we come to the summary judgment stage, what does that mean? Does that mean that who cares if there is some evidence of a dispute? Even though it's an affirmative defense, should summary judgment be granted against that party?
Well, I think that 3308 and the burden shifting that it establishes, Your Honor, does apply at the summary judgment context. I'm not sure that it applies at the trial context. It's like cases in which discriminatory intent or retaliation is at issue and the burden shifts back and forth. Ultimately, the jury isn't instructed on that burden shifting analysis. That's an analysis that the court usually employs in deciding whether there's a sufficient case to submit to the jury. And I think the same thing is true here. And I go back to where I started. In the context of deciding whether there is a question of fact about payment, it's not proper to look at what the bank submitted. It's proper to look at whether the Scotts have any evidence that they made payment on the note. And clearly the record in this case establishes that they do not.
Isn't their accountant's testimony to that? For purposes of summary judgment,
No, Your Honor, and for several reasons, I think. One is that it's clear from Mr. Repp's testimony in his deposition that he based the amortization schedule on Mr. Scott's statement to him that, one, start with the premise that the note was paid in full at maturity, and two, I made payments every month, which Mr. Repp presupposed, both of which are inaccurate. Two, it's again contrary to the Hodevec versus Howe decision in which the court said that you need the underlying documentation, and there is no underlying documentation in this case, Your Honor. And three, it's contrary to all the evidence that does exist in the record. And fourthly, I think that it's ultimately contrary to Mike Scott's letter that he wrote after the date of maturity, and that's in the appendix to my brief at page 14, and I would refer to the court to that because I think it is highly probative in the summary judgment context. It's not unlike the situation in which someone gives deposition testimony and then when confronted with a motion for summary judgment decides to say something else in affidavit form. And this court has said many times that you cannot create a question of material fact for purposes of defeating a motion for summary judgment when you're saying something that's contrary to your own testimony. And in this case, we have a letter from Mike Scott to the Gary Sieverding, a vice president of First Bank, dated September 14, 1995. In which he refers to a meeting that occurred on September 12, and he went to his local bank and discussed with them borrowing the money to pay off the bank. He says, I have no way of coming up with $110,000 to pay off the loan. equipment that is 10 years old will no way cover this loan. And then he specifically proposes to extend the loan for another 10 years from August 21, 1995 to August 21, 2005. We have Mr. Scott, at the time of maturity of this note, not taking issue with the fact that $110,000 is due on the note, but in fact saying, let's extend it for another 10 years.
Didn't he file an affidavit, though, later that was in contradiction to this?
Well, I think the whole amortization schedule is in contradiction to this, Your Honor.
Well, I understand, though, but I mean, for purposes of summary judgment, there was other evidence that he placed under oath. Isn't that correct? It was presented?
Well, I'm trying to remember if there was an affidavit that he submitted in response to the motion for summary judgment. There was an affidavit that he submitted after the circuit court had granted summary judgment. I can't recall if there was one at the time of summary judgment.
I still have a question as well on this. If the underlying documents, let's say for no fault of his own, they were burned up or something, they were lost, they're gone, they're not, there's no way to find them, then how do you present any kind of a defense other than try to recreate it through an accountant, through an amortization schedule, through your own testimony of what you recall, through your prior tax returns? I mean, what was he to do if they're gone and he can't get them from the bank and he no longer has them? Do our rules of evidence, are they so strict that we're not going to allow some manner for him to come forward with his evidence?
Well,
and let it be a question to present to the jury?
I'd like to answer that on the state of the record, Your Honor, which is that it's not clear that Mr. Scott did not have records before 1988. In fact, his affidavit submitted after the circuit court granted summary judgment suggests that he did. He simply didn't want to look for them before the court granted summary judgment, and he did that based in part upon his conclusion that he did not have the burden of proof. And in that sense, he's playing fast and loose with the courts, which I think would be offensive. But secondly, Your Honor, to the extent that the question is whether or not he had the records, I've lost where I was headed.
The reason she did not allow, the trial court did not allow or ruled in your favor, is that there wasn't the documentation to support the summary. Now, if the documentation isn't available or lost, I mean, we're looking at this under the rule of, 1006. Is there another rule that allows that in?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, and I think that, again, there's a legislative determination under 3308 that it's Mr. Scott's burden, and if Mr. Scott ultimately doesn't have the records to meet the burden, I think that ends the inquiry.
What's wrong with his sworn testimony that I've paid over these years?
Well, under this court's cases, Your Honor, I think that there's ample authority that unsupported conclusory statements are not sufficient to create a question of fact for purposes of summary judgment. There are certainly other decisions on actions to enforce notes under 3308 that suggest that those kinds of conclusory statements are not sufficient, and those would be, I think, persuasive authority for this court, and they're cited in the briefs. The point I was going to make, Justice Meyer-Henry, is that there is a specific discovery order in this case that at some point seems to be neglected and should not be, and that is that we specifically asked for any and all documents supporting the defense that you made payment on the note in this case. And the answer that was initially made referred to an interrogatory answer in which Mr. Scott said, well, I made payments every month and Western Bank should have the documents. I don't have anything. And after that, we specifically filed a motion to compel discovery because there was a specific request for documents. And ultimately, the circuit court entered an order compelling discovery, and after that, actually entered an order as a sanction for failing to provide discovery that no documents disclosed after that date could be submitted into evidence. So on the state of the record, Your Honor, again, we have a decision by Mr. Scott that it's not his burden of proof, and therefore he's not going to look at his records even to determine if he does have this stuff. And we have an order from the circuit court saying you're precluded from entering anything else. And so on the basis of the record, the question is, what is there in the record that could defeat defeat the bank's motion for summary judgment, and the answer is there are no records in the there are no documents in the record that would support the amortization schedule, and that is, I think, the only thing based on the burden of proof that could defeat summary judgment. And I would simply refer the court to the Premier Bank case from the the Louisiana Court of Appeals, because again there was an argument made there that surely there must be some question of fact, because there were issues about whether the plaintiff's proof in that case, whether the bank's proof was so lock solid that there was no question of fact about it. And the court of the court on appeal said that doesn't matter. The plaintiff's burden of proof is straightforward, and that is simply to prove entitlement to the amount evidenced by the note, and then the defendant has the burden of proving payment. And I think this is the significant passage. It says, moreover, we fail to understand the trial court's distinction between proof of the existence of the debt and proof of the amount of the debt. The amount of the debt was the face amount of the notes. Plaintiff does not have the burden of proving non-payment. Payment is an affirmative defense which must be pleaded and proved by the defendant. Anytime you start looking to the sufficiency of the bank records in claiming that $109,948 is the amount due at maturity and find a question of fact about that, you have shifted the burden of proof away from the Scotts and onto the bank. And that is expressly contrary to 3308, and that is what this decision says. The only evidence.
There's a word you use in your briefs that I'm just curious about. You say several times that the Scott's evidence was not credible. Was that a word the trial court used also?
I can't recall if that is actually contained in the memorandum decision that Judge Caldwell.
You're arguing a little differently today. Now you're saying there really was no evidence, but in a brief you seem to use the word credible, if I recall correctly.
Well, and it may be a semantic argument, Your Honor. It might have been better not to say credible, because that suggests in the summary judgment context that somebody's
right.
Making a decision about the validity of the evidence that ought to be made by a fact finder. I think
can
that
court
it's
make a qualitative determination that the evidence is implausible, incredible, and therefore is not worthy of even being considered in summary judgment?
I'm sorry, I missed the beginning of the question.
Can a court make a determination that the evidence is so implausible or so incredible that it's not worthy of consideration for summary judgment?
I think that can happen, Your Honor, and again, I think there are cases cited in the brief in which this court has said that unsupported conclusory statements are not sufficient to create a question of fact for summary judgment. I don't think that that's what happened in this case, and I don't think that that's the basis on which this court has to make a determination to affirm or reverse in this case. I think that affirmance can be based on the absence of any documentary evidence in the record supporting Mr. Rep's amortization schedule. And I'm not prepared to say that were there documents supporting Mr. Rep's amortization schedule that it would be sufficient to create a question of fact that would have to be resolved by a jury in this case. And the reason I'm saying that is because of the evidence from the Scotts themselves, which suggests that in fact $109,985 was the amount that was due at maturity. And again, I'd go back to the letter from September of 1995 in which Mr. Scott does not dispute that that amount was due. The record is very clear that Mr. Scott took advantage of the situation once he was informed by the SBA that the SBA was not going to honor the terms of its guarantee. And there's no surprise that the SBA has some interest in doing that. If it can avoid payment on a guarantee, it's within its legal rights to avoid doing that. In this case, Mr. Scott took no action to suggest that the loan had been paid in full until after he learned that the SBA was taking that position, and that's reflected in the SBA's own internal documents. Once he discovered that, all of a sudden he went to his accountant, Mr. Rep, and said, let's put together an amortization schedule. You start from the premise that this was paid in full on the date of maturity.
Right, but he's corrected that. At least, I mean, maybe he's done it too late, but in the motion for reconsideration, he comes up now with another. He looks at his records and he says, all right, now I agree, I do owe some money. Did the trial court examine that, or did the trial court simply say it's too late for me to examine that?
Well, I think that there is no decision in the record outlining the court's rationale for denying the motion for reconsideration, as I recall. I may be wrong about that. There may be a brief letter decision, but I think what the trial court said is, one, it's too late. You made a tactical decision about the burden of proof. You specifically refused to look for these documents. There's a discovery order in place that says you can't produce them at this point. It is too late now to come up with this. As a procedural matter at this point, Your Honor, there has been no appeal from the separate order denying the motion for reconsideration. And so I think it's properly before this court only in the sense that you can be aware that Mr. Scott's position has changed depending upon the circumstances and how it might be favorable to him. Beyond that, I don't think this court has jurisdiction to expressly consider the court's denial of the motion for reconsideration.
Mr. Moore, your time is almost up, but I need to ask you this. In your brief, you state that this case involves a dispute over the amount of principal due on a promissory note. Are you aware of any South Dakota case where we've ever affirmed summary judgment where there's a dispute over a fact like this?
I'm not aware of any South Dakota cases addressing an action to enforce a note under 3308 like this, Your Honor.
Or just in general where there's a dispute of fact.
Well, I'm aware.
You know where I'm going here.
Sure.
The cases are just legion that where there's a dispute of fact like this, summary judgment is not granted.
But there are also cases, Your Honor, that unsupported conclusory statements are not sufficient to create a question of fact for summary judgment. And that summary judgment in appropriate cases is not something that the court should be afraid of, and it's not something that is in some way illegitimate. And there are cases from other jurisdictions saying that actions to enforce notes are especially appropriate cases for summary judgment. And I think the court could look to those and rely on them. I would say candidly, if ever there were a case for summary judgment, this is it.
Judge Yang, did you have a question?
No, that's fine.
All right. Your time has expired. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Fisher, you have 10 minutes, sir.
In this case, the bank set out numerous, almost 50 findings of fact and conclusions of law that weren't really disputed. The one referred to by the bank's counsel was number 38, in which it stated that Rep prepared the amortization solely upon the basis of Scott's own representations of what had happened 10 years earlier, and upon assorted tax returns of the Scotts, which did not indicate the amount of principal and interest paid on the note.
Could I just interrupt you 1 second? You made the statement there about findings of fact. Did the court make findings of fact?
No, undisputed, statement of undisputed facts.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, for this summary judgment. And he cited his authority for that, Rep's deposition at pages 7, 11, and 16. So I looked at those pages, and they don't support what the bank stated in that undisputed fact, because, in fact, the deposition of Scott, it did indicate the amount of principal and interest paid on the note, and he says that. When he says that, question, did you review any documents that support the payments that are set out in the amortization schedule? Answer, just the documents that I gave you a copy of that. At that point in time, we probably had the 86 and 87 returns available, you know, and that would have backed up the 86 and 87 and 88 payments. But like I said, those tax returns for those years, we don't have copies of anymore, and so, you know, those statements indicate payments that were made. That's at page 7, and at page 11, question. So in 1996, when you prepared this amortization schedule, your recollection is that you did not have or would not have had any documents for 1985. That's correct, because it had been destroyed with the 10-year keeping question. Do you recall whether you had any documents from 86 to look at? Answer. We would have had the 86 tax return, and we would have had the 87 and 88 then also at that point in time. Question. So that's what you recall looking at when you made up this amortization schedule. You did not have the 85 tax returns, but you did have the 86, 87, and 88 tax returns. That's correct, yes. Do you have those tax returns today? No, we don't. After 10 years, our policy is to shred everything. So that, again, is what the CPA testified to. Now, another finding submitted by the plaintiff was that the SBA ultimately declined to honor its guarantee on the note, in part because of the wide variance between the bank's and the Scott's amortization schedule. And at page A7 attached, the appendix attached to the bank's brief, is a notification of administrative action by the SBA, and in that document, it stated, quote, the SBA has knowledge of or evidence to suggest negligence on the part of the claimant. The bank has not been able to account for all of the payments that have been made from October 31, 85 until September 23, 88. They go on to say, by paying the bank and not being able to account for all payments being made on this loan, this could jeopardize SBA ability to collect from the guarantors per SBA counsel. Now, that indicates to me that without these records, if the SBA were to take this loan and proceed against the guarantors, who are the Scotts, the SBA, having the burden of proof, could not meet that burden of proof because the bank didn't keep the records. Now, I also want to go back and summarize that the authorities that I've cited in my brief places the burden upon the plaintiff bank approving the amounts due. And they say that that burden is consistent with the rule that in a suit on a promissory note, a claimant makes a prima facie case against the maker by producing the note signed by the maker and showing the balance due. Here, the bank has not shown the balance due by competent proof. And in another case, Hovendick versus Presidential Financial Corporation, the court said, once Presidential introduced the note and established a prima facie right to judgment on the note, the burden shifted to Hovendick and Spolin to produce evidence showing a different amount owed and thereby creating a jury issue. That's what we have in this case.
Now, Mr. Moore says, however, that the lower court ordered you to provide some of this documentation, and that was not done, and that was part of the reason that the court went ahead with the summary judgment.
Well, the at that point, as I said, Mr. Scott was under the impression that the bank had all these records anyway, and he has two warehouses full of boxes of many different companies. And so Why wouldn't the bank just comply with our request for production and produce the documentation to support their summary or their amortization schedule? And when we go to the hearing on summary judgment, that's when the first time we found out was, if you don't have the records, you lose.
Well, are you suggesting that your client be rewarded for his sloppy record keeping?
Pardon?
Are you suggesting your client be rewarded for sloppy record keeping? You're saying, well, you had two warehouses of boxes. Well, there's a lot of companies that have two warehouses of boxes. And is that a defense to a production order or a summary judgment motion that I did such a poor job of filing them, I can't find them now?
Well, maybe it is sloppy, but I'm urging this court not to affirm a summary judgment with this evidence of the bank's sloppy record keeping. The question is, Where did this $109,000 number come from? There is a wide variance between the two positions. And maybe Scott was sloppy in his record keeping, but so was the bank. As a matter of fact, the SBA didn't want to touch this because they knew without those records, we can't collect it. And in another document submitted to the plaintiff's brief, the SBA indicates that the bank now believes that the best course of action is just to do nothing and let this matter die because they don't have the records. So instead of justice, I mean, we're stuck with the bank's amortization schedule with its numerous errors, and we've been precluded from having this hotly disputed fact issue submitted to a fact finder. We urge this court to reverse and send this case back for a trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.